That wonderful long passage from the Path that Tony read so well, describing that ridiculous discussion between Master and one of his disciples, that Devi Mukherjee is a, some of you have been to India and have met a man of the same name. It's a different person, just to clarify that, but Devi Mukherjee, as we called him there, is a very enthusiastic, energetic sort of person who was always demanding different things. I think eventually Master sent him back to India. I don't think it worked that well for him in America. But one of the pictures among many things that that whole philosophical discussion illustrates is the sort of easy way that Master related to his devotees and the relaxation that Master had himself with his own wisdom, with his own state of consciousness. It's so different than this really false picture we have of spiritual beings sort of moving through the world in this very unnatural manner. I read part of a novel that was supposedly set in the Essene times. I'm always interested in those legend, myth, stories, revealed history of the period of time when Jesus lived and the remnants of the higher ages that were still there in these esoteric communities. It's pretty well established that Jesus was part of the Essenes and that the tradition that he presented was not really so fragmented from the world around him as some people thought it was. That what it was really is that when Jesus was born, it was higher ages descending. We're now on lower ages ascending. We're coming into a time of greater understanding. What happened when Jesus was born is that they were gradually losing understanding, and it got darker and darker. And the Essene community was one of those fragments that it held from a higher age, that as the world was less and less enlightened, that the truths went deeper and deeper into secrecy. And little bands of souls who had the capability to keep a higher understanding still alive were maintaining that, and that was the context into which Jesus was born. And they had the intuition, in fact, to even know that the Messiah was coming. But what I was saying was about this particular novel, that there's a tendency to think, if you go back in history, especially if you go to a time that's exotic, like when Jesus was there, that all the rules of human nature just suddenly change, and people become a different kind of human. Many times you'll read these historically interesting statements of a father commenting about the next generation and his despairing over the future of the race because of the behavior of his son, and then you'll see it was written in 300 AD or something like that, and it's just the same attitudes and relationships. But in this novel, they had these poor scenes pretty much before they did just about anything. They would change into their ritual white clothes, and then they would go through all this ritual washing, and perhaps there were some kinds of ceremonies like that, but just think, if every time you all came in here, everybody had to go through a whole ritual washing, and everybody had to put on their white robes, and then when you left, you had to go through the ritual washing, and you take them off, and then when you went out and had lunch, you did one thing, and then when you came back for a meeting, you had to do the ritual washing and put on the white clothes again. I mean, you would just do nothing but change your clothes and do laundry. Really, that would be all that you would have time to do. That just isn't how it works. It's much more relaxed and natural in any age. And stories like Kriyananda has written about his life with Master and the big book that's just come out, Conversations with Yogananda, are so helpful because on one hand, they show you the exalted level at which these masters lived. Here's Yogananda trying to have this discussion about the fine distinction between the fact that his consciousness is infinite, but his body isn't, but if there's no ego, then there's no I to claim that it's God. It's all very complex, and Devi Mukherjee is just all of us, just basically saying, huh? You know, what are you talking about? And then trying to pin it down into some little part of the mind that we can really grasp. The process of the spiritual path is becoming more and more comfortable with a completely other perception of reality, just a completely different way of looking at everything about life. Swami Kriyananda, through the years, has often been quite mystifying to people who have a more linear way of working. In fact, Swamiji said Virgos always had trouble in the early years of Ananda because they were just very exacting about how they wanted things to be done. And Swamiji was never exacting in the ways people expected him to be exacting. In fact, the beginning of Ananda was really quite a mess. There's really no other way to describe it. We had hundreds, and we still do, at Ananda Village, hundreds of acres of land, totally impossible to manage all that land, and we would just, and no money with which to do anything, and we would just carve out little fragments of space in which we could function. I was talking to my friends, I just spent 2 weeks up there, and I was remembering with my friend Seva when we first built what was then the publications building, which is now called Hansa Temple. It was this very unusual structure, is an unusual structure with this curved roof. And the winters there, it's about 2,500 feet. And 30 years ago almost, the weather was colder. All through the winter, it would snow a lot and rain a lot. And most of us didn't have cars. We'd just tromp around in it in our felt-lined boots and our rain suits. And we built this building in it. We were starting the first fall moving into it. And I went to work there, and I walked all over that building, and I perceived, to my mind, a really terrible lack. I went to Seva. I said, Seva, there's no heat in this building. She said, yeah, we ran out of money before we could put it in. Whoa, there's no heat. So we got these little tiny space heaters, and you just sort of sit there huddled up against this little tiny space heater while it would be like snowing outside. We'd have to wear more clothes in the building than outside the building. There's pictures of all of us, and you think that we were very, very chubby people. Because it was just, we had to wear so many clothes just to work. One of the girls had to put a heating pad on her, she had a typesetting machine. It was, it would just get so cold it wouldn't work, so she'd put the heating pad on it and then it would heat up a little bit, then she could work on it. She had little gloves with fingertips out of them. You know, but it was just the way things were. It was just, we knew what we were doing. Now you go up there and you still see all kinds of things that could be different, but it's progressed so far. And over the years working with Swamiji, I would so often see him do things that to my mind didn't make any sense. For example, whenever we had a financial crisis, instead of contracting, which is what every normal person would do, Swamiji would always launch another major project. When the community nearly went bankrupt from the fire in 1976, after, so many years of just struggling to even have enough places, humble though they were, for people to live, in 3 hours on a June afternoon, 21 houses were burned down, which was pretty much everything we had that wasn't a trailer or a teepee. This fire just came through the property, and it was so conscientious. It would just, like, you looked at the pattern afterward, and the fire would just make a long finger to go out here and get a house, burn it up, and then it would just go right back. And it burned down all the houses where the families lived. It left the monks and nuns who were living in little trailers on one side, and it left Swami's house. Just took down all those major houses except for one, and then a month later an oak tree fell on it. And Swamiji's response to that was to do two nationwide tours. I mean, he just launched this huge effort called the Joy Tours, and he took a dozen people and he got a motorhome and this big van, and he went out and just went to 40 cities in 3 months, and then he turned around and came home for a few months and then went out and did it all again. And he announced, we're going to earn all this money, we need money to rebuild, we'll go out across the country, we'll come back with thousands of dollars. Of course, we lost tens of thousands of dollars on the whole effort, and many people said, you don't know what you're doing, Swami, you're not practical like that. But, well, about 15 or 20 of our most notable members, including my husband, and many others, Sheila Rush and Kathy Perugino and other names that I could mention, and David Praver, all came to Ananda because of that tour. And you sort of think, well, maybe we lost money, but we went out and we found the devotees and we brought people back, and how much did people contribute? Like Sheila Rush contributed 12 years of her legal expertise to save Ananda from oblivion in a lawsuit. You know, if Swami hadn't gone out on that joy tour and brought her back from New York City, where she was happily ensconced as a law professor. And years of this effort from Swamiji, one day it finally occurred to me, it sounds so naive, Swami doesn't work with the material world. Swamiji works with energy and magnetism. Now, you would think that a person would know that. But when you actually see the divine force contradicting the little human mind over and over and over again, it's harder than you think to just shift your understanding and move with that. So many times, this is the most, was the most extreme example. I mentioned briefly the lawsuit that we were involved in. We had this trial in Redwood City. It was just a complete travesty of justice, which is a story that I don't want to go into. Everything, absolutely everything, the judge, our own attorney, everything worked against us, absolutely. As Swamiji said later, the law of averages says at least something will go your way. He said, when everything goes against you, you know Divine Mother is running the show. Well, that's what we were in. Every single day for like several months, I think it was. And Swamiji and everyone was living in our house. And every morning we'd come down and we'd have breakfast at our big table. We'd all eat breakfast together. Then we'd all head off to this sort of hopeless task of going to this courtroom to have our reputations just savaged and then reported in the newspapers the next day. And I mean, it was just an absolute disaster. Every morning, Swami would say, I feel like today's the day the tide's going to turn. You know, I was watching juror number 6, the one who's been so sour, and I think he's beginning to come around to our side. He would sit at the head of this table. There were about 12 of us at the table, and every morning we would say, not a chance, sir. Not a chance, no way. Like somehow we had like this duty to make sure that that even if he had the tiniest bit of optimism, we crushed it at breakfast. Right, like that. We went on day after day after day like this. And you would sort of wonder, like, was Swami in a different courtroom? You know? But he was more astute, more acutely aware of what was going on than anyone. Some of us were not even allowed in. But no matter how hard he would try, we would always make sure that our realistic mind stopped it until the very last morning when I finally said, you know, he's not stupid. He probably knows what he's doing. And then I thought, I bet he's working with magnetism. I bet he's trying to get some positive force going here to counter all this negative that's overwhelming us. So that morning when Swami said, I think the judge is turning our way, you know, they're based on no facts whatsoever, I said, yes, sir, I think that's true. Everybody at the table just looked at me like, you know, not you too. Is it in the orange juice? What is happening here? But it was a little late. Then months later, I was talking to Swamiji, and I get to test my perceptions a lot of times. Sir, I was thinking about all those breakfasts when you tried to be a little positive and we made sure that nobody was positive before we left. I said, you were just trying to generate a little magnetism, weren't you? He said, of course. You know, of course. I said, and every morning, we just did our best to just cut the ground right out from under you, didn't we? Yes, he said, you did. You know, I said, but it's a very fine line, isn't it, sir, between being naive and living in a dream world and actually generating real power by seeing a higher reality. And Swami said, yes, it's a very fine line. You have to be very careful. Now, this just like gives us just this clue of how this divine force works. And it's not enough. You see people who are positive, but they don't have energy behind that positivism. You see, what Swamiji has is this power to stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds, and then he can look beyond the horizon line to the real potential of what's going to happen. That's where Master stands. This little body is not God. This devotee's trying to say, you, Yogananda, because you're special, you're so super, you're the infinite, aren't you, aren't you, aren't you? Yogananda just... there's nothing he can do to embrace such an attitude. How could he accept such a thing? So he repudiates it repeatedly, despite the fact that the disciple keeps trying to paste it on him. It's a whole other world that we're talking about. We're talking about a force that's infinite in this nature that just rushes over this little thing that we call ourselves. This is the power of light that incarnates. And in the Gita, they make this statement. It's a very interesting statement. Whenever virtue declines, I take visible form to restore Dharma, to restore right action. Now, we think of that as the explanation. In the Hindu tradition, the incarnation of God has come again and again and again. So they have to explain it. In the Christian tradition, he just came once. So we don't have this problem of really what Jesus was. Every question is answered by he was special, right? But in the Indian tradition, where you have Krishna and Rama and Ramakrishna and Yogananda himself and Jesus, who is incorporated, where this power of the infinite comes again and again, you have to understand it differently. But there's another explanation that's so sweet within the Gita, because the Gita has every level at once. It's not just about how the world is, it's also how the individual soul functions. Whenever our own inner sense of Dharma slips away from us, if we are watching, if we are willing to look behind the obvious, the divine will take visible form to restore our understanding. Even in that terrible experience of those lawsuits, every morning Swamiji was trying to say to us, lift your consciousness above what is happening, and not only to perceive God behind it, but actually to draw God into it. A prayer of love went up from earth and you responded. That's what we say in the Festival of Light every week. Everything in creation goes up in wordless yearning in a prayer for redemption. That prayer goes up and God responds. A ray of your light flashed out from infinity, burst downward through night skies of consciousness, and was born on earth for the redemption of mankind in human form. We're talking about the avatars. But the human form we're also talking about is the rebirth of that spirit within us. Every hour of darkness is followed by the inevitable dawn. And the greatest requirement of human life is not to lose contact with that power. And above all, not to lose hope that no matter how dark the hour may be, and God knows on this planet, the hours can become very dark. The human body just begins to wane. The human mind begins to grow weaker. The human hopes become smashed over and over. Or maybe we're cashing in all our chips and we have a perfect incarnation. But then we just look around at others who also suffer. But always behind that, we think that one thing is happening. We see the waves moving on the surface. But deep within, look to your own self. That's where the power lies. That's what the little bird is told. You know, seek that power within yourself. That there's nothing on this earth that is really bigger than that divine force within. And everything in this earth, everything in the material world responds to the power of spirit. Swami Kriyananda wrote a course called Material Success Through Yogic Principles. And he wrote it in response, as some of you know, this was a couple of years ago, he wrote it in India. He was nearly dead of pneumonia in the hospital. But Swamiji is such a peculiar patient that even when his physical body is so debilitated, the spirit radiates out from this completely emaciated form. I remember when he was here a few years ago, he came out and he sort of came out and stood on this platform, and Shanti, the physician, mentioned later, she said she'd never seen such a combination of complete physical weakness and spiritual power. She was divided, if I'm quoting you accurately, she was divided, she said, between being a devotee and a doctor. The doctor was poised, ready to rush and revive him when he inevitably fell over, which is what she expected to have happen. And the devotee was just motionless with this spiritual power that was pouring out of him. So Swamiji was in the hospital, nearly dying of pneumonia, and this doctor perceived him as somebody who could help him. So the doctor says, I have this dilemma. He said, it's very hard for me to make the money I need without cutting corners, but it hurts my moral spirit to not live in Dharma. What can I do? So Swami, you know, sort of like, maybe we can talk about it tomorrow kind of energy. But Swami gave him a little bit of an answer, and then from what, you know, looked like it might be his deathbed, but didn't turn out to be, he just had this inspiration to write a course of lessons about how to find material success without compromising honor. Now, Swamiji doesn't really care about people getting rich, so this is not your normal get-rich-quick course. This is something very different and very interesting. This is how to control and relate to the material plane from the spiritual level. In other words, magnetism. If we understand this world to be consciousness, spirit, and energy, then how do we relate? And it puts the lie to all this thought that, oh, I'll just grab for myself and be selfish and I don't care about others and who cares who gets hurt as long as I get my position and looking out for me. All that makes sense If your perspective is like here, you know, just wave crashing against wave, but when you understand that every wave is a manifestation of the ocean, where does the power of the wave come from? I mean, how much power can you have as an individual wave compared to the power that you would have when you embrace the ocean? Now, that's the power that incarnates within us again and again and again and again. Whenever virtue declines within us, whenever our hope wanes, whenever we're tempted to find an easier way, thinking that we can cut corners and get away with it. A friend of mine, she had difficulty with her child when he was small, but her way of coping with it was to hope she could just outlast him. And then he became a rebellious teenager, and she realized that she really just had to face into this project of raising this child. And she said so sweetly, "I thought I was going to get away with it. You know, I thought I was just not going to really have to put out the energy." And so it is, incarnation after incarnation. We think we're going to get away with it. I'm going to be a little selfish about this, a little snide about that, a little revengeful here, and I'm just going to hold on to my pride over there. And we just sort of think, well, I've got a good job, and I'm making lots of money, and I have a nice home. I think I'm going to get away with it. But sooner or later, our happiness just fades. Because to whatever extent we violate divine law, we suffer. It's really not complicated. We simply suffer. And God gives us very challenging situations, you know, but even shadows on a statue give light and substance to hope. It's so that we will be driven deeper to find joy on an ever deeper level. God is not satisfied with a little superficial happiness for us. He wants us to have the infinity of bliss. And every time we begin to fade out from that thought, God will take visible form, sometimes in the form of blessing, sometimes in the form of trials. But one way or another, God will take visible form to restore the virtue of our hearts, to restore our understanding, to restore that light within us, to restore our bliss. Bless you.